Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 761 of the Comics Sports Podcast. I'm your host, Jace.
I'm Manny.
And this is our new Comics Wednesday episode, and it's brought to you by Aftershock Comics, the independent comics and graphic novel publisher sending shockwaves throughout your local comic shop with groundbreaking series like A Walk Through Hell by Garth Ennis and Gorod Suzuka, Animosity by Marguerite Bennett and Raphael Della Torre. Latest issue is in comic shops today, and Manny's going to give you a sneak preview of that. Also, Dark Arc by Cullen Bunn and Juan Doe. The latest issue of that is out as well. And there's also new must-reads, big hits like Oberon by Ryan Parrott and Milo Slavkovic, which is red hot right now and getting lots of critical acclaim. Also, Stronghold from Phil Hester and Ryan Kelly. And coming real soon, we have Dark Red, a tale of vampirism in the heart of America from Tim Seeley and Corin Howell. And just announced recently, we have Trustfall from Christopher Sabella with art by Chris Visions. What happens when you have the ability to teleport valuables, weapons, and even your own accomplices, but not yourself? Well, for Ash Parson, it means every job is a Trustfall, and she has to hope her family, who are struggling to establish a criminal empire, are there to catch her. Look for this exciting new title coming in June. So be sure to check out all that's shaking at Aftershock.com and remember to read dangerously. Obviously, Manny and I are big fans of Aftershock. We talk about their comics every Monday on Aftershock Monday, and we have creator interviews and exclusive announcements and giveaways and all that kind of great stuff for you. So again, it's one of those publishers that's doing everything right. Really edgy, groundbreaking series. You get titles there that can't be necessarily published anywhere else. Really high quality. And, you know, with creators like Marguerite Bennett, Donnie Cates, Garth Ennis, you know, these are really creators who've made a name for themselves in the industry. And if you see them start going back and doing things with Aftershock again and again and again, it just goes to show you how high quality the people that work there are, and how much editorial support and marketing and all that kind of good stuff that Aftershock offers as opposed to some other publishers. So again, you really owe it to yourself to check out some of these titles. Go to AftershockComics.com. They have rundowns of all the different series they have there, what they're about. They have the Diamond Code, so you can pre-order from your local comic shop. And they even have links to purchase them digitally on Comixology. So really encourage you to go and check them out. All right, so on to the episode. Manny and I, as we normally do on these new Comic Wednesday episodes, have had a chance to check out some of the books that are going to be on stands today through the preview copies that the publishers send us, to which we are eternally grateful for them giving us the opportunity to check these out so we can let you guys know what to be on the lookout for when you head into your local comic shop today or later in the week. So let's go ahead and kick it off with your first book, Manny. What do you have up next?
For the first book, I'm going to go ahead and I thought this was on the first page, and now I can't find it. Wonder Twins, number 2, written by Mark Russell with artwork by Stephen Byron. And so this picks up with one of the most dastardly villains that we've ever seen in comics, the Scrambler, who escapes out of Lexicon prison and call center. So the book starts with the Wonder Twins not being able to go to Planetarium because it's too expensive. But they're going to go visit the prison, which is where they learn that most of the prisoners also work as telemarketers. And apparently they have a 90% rate of people that don't reoffend. So I think probably if you're going to end up having to work at a call center, you really don't want to go back to prison. Makes a lot of sense. So Superman introduces the Wonder Twins to Beast Boy, who, like, we've you know what, this is a question I wanted to ask you. Beast Boy, is he in other classic series on TV also? Is he into entertainment?
He's been in like the Teen Titans cartoons and stuff.
No, I mean, like, in the cartoons, like, as his character, does he also, on in other stories, is he also like a TV star?
You know, I don't remember him ever, like, not the classic Beast Boy. That was never, I don't think it was ever a thing. I think he might have been aspiring to. But I think in the newer one, in the newer Teen Titans, he's if not necessarily a TV star, but sort of like a social, like media, like a YouTube kind of personality.
Okay. Well, the only reason I ask is because that's how he's featured here.
Yeah, doing a commercial.
And also in the new season of Young Justice, he's featured as a TV star.
Yeah, I think, like I said, I think either in the new 52 or the Rebirth Teen Titans, yeah, they kind of made him like a YouTube personality, pseudo celebrity kind of guy. I don't know if I'd go so far as to say he's a TV star, but he's certainly somebody that like people follow on social media and people know who he is and that kind of thing.
Oh, okay. That's what I asked. Anyway, so Superman thinks that Beast Boy would be the perfect mentor for the twins. And so they had a pretty good conversation about controlling their powers. Meanwhile, the Scrambler is trying to get back in the Legion of Doom. And Lex Luthor kind of blows him off. And he is set to join kind of the farm system of the Legion of Doom called the League of Annoyance, which is led by somebody named Praying Mantis. And they also have Auntie Phenomene, which is funny. And then also Baron Nightblood, a.k.a. Druncula. So I think that's it's a pretty funny team. And it's a really good issue overall. But kind of like you and I were talking off the air, man, like Mark Russell has a really good talent to make his books really light and super dark at the same time. And this is the case with issue two. So it makes the book really, really entertaining because it just takes your emotions from up and down, and it has some funny moments and some dark moments and back to funny. And it's like, oh man, like this is pretty good. I really enjoyed that when he did that on the Flintstones. I thought he was the perfect guy to write that and to kind of bring it into this time of day. And he seems to be doing the exact same thing now with the Wonder Twins, which is fantastic. And it needs to be checked out. I really, really enjoy the artwork, the colors. It goes along really, really well with the book. Some of the characters are highlighted and such. The only thing I don't like is they make Superman look kind of puny, but that's me nitpicking. But like I said, overall, it's a really good book so far. Even last issue was a little bit lighter. This one got dark real quick. And it really interested to see where he goes going forward with issue three. And if it continues to feature some of these, I don't know, Class C villains or so, and where they go with that. Also, you know, just how involved the Wonder Twins are going to get with the league, or are they just going to be off on their own, kind of like they've been the last these two issues?
Yeah, I totally agree with you on the Steven Byrne art. He, you know, we saw him on Green Arrow, and I wouldn't say that his style is ever dark and gritty, kind of. But it looked obviously was a much more of a street style when he did Green Arrow. Here, it's pretty light and innocent, and you know, almost a Silver Age feel, which really suits the book because there are a lot of funny jokes and funny moments and funny sight gags and stuff. But like you said, with Mark Russell, his humor is really smart. And there are those jokes that are really obvious, but then there's kind of the satire part, the social commentary part, which if you want to spend time thinking about that, is humorous in a different way. Certainly kind of a dark humor, if you will, which is kind of what satire is. You know, you could look at this as a comment on the prison system, or the revolving door of, recidivism and things like that. Even commenting on things as simple as, yeah, there's no money for field trips in schools anymore. So he throws that stuff out there and doesn't necessarily call attention to it. But when you go back and think about it, you can see that he is sort of making a social commentary on a lot of these different things. So yeah, it's really, really, it's an interesting issue because it sort of transcends, you know, all age levels, because you could give this to a kid and have them read it, and it would just be, you know, fun for them to see, you know, the Scrambler and Druncula and, you know, Amphetamine and the Mantis and these goofy looking villains. And we also get the first appearance of Gleek, the Wonder Twins monkey, in this issue. So all that stuff's great and works for, you know, younger readers. But then for the older readers, like I said, there's all that social commentary. So yeah, it's been a really fun series so far. Like Manny said, only two issues in. Hopefully it continues at this high level. All right, let's see. What am I going to talk about first? Let me talk about Justice League Dark. From writer James Tynan IV, we have art by, pencils, I should say, by Alvaro Martinez Bueno and Miguel Mendoca, and inks by Raul Fernandez and Mendoca. Colors are by Brad Anderson, letters by Rob Lee. We saw at the end of last issue that the Lords of Order, which are supposed to be good guys, had sort of stopped being good guys. For whatever reason, Naboo, who most people will know as Dr. Fate, he's sort of the Lord of Order who inhabits the helmet that Kent Nelson would wear. We saw that he returned to Mira, which is the land that that mystical, magical land that the Nightmaster used to be in charge of, and now Bobo's charged with protecting it, because he has the Sword of Night. And so Mira is his responsibility. But the Lords of Order, sort of encouraged by Naboo, are not content just to kind of guide humanity anymore, because of all the machinations and things that have been going on with the broken source wall and magic being broken and the others coming from that dark dimension to sort of take over Earth again. And so the Lords of Order believe that they have to take it upon themselves to basically destroy this reality and the magic that it contains, so that the others won't have anything to feed on. And then the Lords of Order can sort of rebuild. Well, obviously our heroes in the Justice League Dark don't want that to happen. They don't want everybody to die. And so, as you can imagine, there's a pretty epic struggle. So it's great. I don't know that we've ever met the other Lords of Order before, besides Naboo. So that it's great to see that. This issue also guest stars the Demon, who is starting to have a higher profile in the DCU lately, between his recent miniseries and now showing up here. And so the things that happen with him are sort of unprecedented. I'll say, haven't really been done before with the Demon character. So that's interesting. And in a way, this is almost a transitional issue, because it's a lot of setup for what's going to happen next. But the thing is, this one is so fast paced that you don't really it doesn't really feel like a down issue. A lot of times when a writer has to create an issue like this, where he's basically just moving characters around and putting them in place for the next issue for some big events to happen, which the next issue following this, the blurb at the end says the death of Mira, which again is that magical land. But when a writer has to move all the pieces around, it can feel clunky and it can feel kind of slow. And, you know, it's just, you're like very aware that this is a sort of a setup issue that's just putting everybody in their place for the big battle or the big climax or whatever. Tynan does a great job of packing this issue with information, with giving us a background into how we got to this place in terms of the characters that are sort of central to Dr. Fate, like Kent Nelson and the rest of the Lords of Order. And then also, how does Man-Bat fit in? How does the Justice League Dark fit in? So we get all of that. Plus, we get some Zatanna and Wonder Woman information, as they're away from the rest of the Justice League Dark right now, trying to search for their own answers to the others. They're trying to find a way to defeat them. And then we have the rest of the League in the magical land of Mira, and then they're confronted by these Lords of Order. So again, there's a lot of moving pieces and a lot of setup with moving people around. But I think that, first of all, the art is spectacular. And Tynan just does a good job of packing it with information that feels important. And then we get the kind of the action scenes with the demon that helps speed it along. So it feels like it's relatively quickly paced, and it really sets up a big event coming up. The death of Mira, as it says. So there's going to be some kind of incredible battle, I assume, between these Lords of Order and the Justice League Dark. But just to go back to the art for a second, I mean, I am just blown away by the art. I can't really tell. I think Miguel Mendoza and Bueno's art, Alvaro Martinez Bueno, their art is similar enough that I can't really tell who did what, which is great. But it's all spectacular. There are so many montages and big splash pages that have little insets that give us even more action that's going on. I mean, the art in Justice League Dark has been pretty spectacular, like throughout, like every single issue. But this art-wise is probably my favorite issue so far. I mean, it is stunningly good. Like right when you open it, on the first page, you have, as I said, like a full-page splash. But then you have little insets that give you some more information. But on that full page splash, it's a full page splash of Dr. Fate, a close up of Dr. Fate and his helmet. And in his helmet, you see reflections of other events that have happened and have affected the Justice League Dark over time. And so it's almost like, even though it's a splash page, it's a bunch of little scenes that flesh out the story, and it's done so well. The backgrounds are spectacular. The color work by Brad Anderson, who's really kind of an underrated colorist, it's all spectacular. It's all so good. You know, seeing Kent Nelson walk around his tower, which, you know, looks like an M.C. Escher drawing, if you know who that is. You know, he's the one that always does the staircases that kind of lead to nowhere and tricks of perspective and whatever, or maybe you. Maybe a lot more of you know, like the halls and the stairways at Hogwarts, how they kind of move and go in all kinds of weird directions. So that's all rendered exceptionally well. Seeing these Lords of Order for the first time, and they're, you know, like we know Naboo, and we know he has a helmet. Well, there's another one that has gauntlets. Another one has a cloak. Another one has a breastplate. Another one is boots. So it's all different sorts of, different articles of clothing. And you almost wonder, so what would happen if one of them put on all the stuff? Like, how cool would that look? So again, it's just a really, really well-paced issue, chock full of information, incredible artwork. And art-wise, my favorite issue so far. And like, I don't know anybody who could read this issue and not have to read the next one. I mean, that's how well it sets up and really makes you want to know, okay, what the heck is going to happen next? Because there are all these different characters that are on the verge of discovering something or having something really important happen. And there's all these moving pieces. And Tynan's doing a great job of keeping all the storylines moving and making them all interesting. None of them feel like they're dragging. It's just really, really well done. It's funny because whenever I read the regular Justice League title, I think, man, this title is so good. This is my favorite Justice League book. And then Justice League Dark comes out and I read it and I'm like, this is so good. This is my favorite Justice League book. So I guess the answer is my favorite Justice League book is whichever one I've read most recently. So, and I know you're a couple issues behind, man. If you got to get caught up, man, this issue was just stunningly good. It was so, so, so good. So. It's all you. What do you have next?
The next book I'll talk about is going to be Image Comics Assassination Nation number one. The creative team is written by Kyle Sparks with artwork by Erica Henderson. And let me tell you, I thought I remembered the name Kyle Sparks from something I've been reading, and it's because he also writes he does Rick and Morty over at
Oni.
What publisher? I'm sorry?
Isn't it Oni Press that does Rick and Morty?
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it is. And then also from Oni Press, he did last year Dead of Winter, Good Good Dog, which was pretty good. And then also I have been reading it's a miniseries, just because I'm I think it's a funny movie, Mars Attacks. He did a Mars Attack series also over at Dynamite, like a 5-part series. So I kind of, after reading this first issue and kind of seeing the other work that he's done, it kind of gave me a good idea of where we're headed. I think it looks like we're headed in a really, really good direction. So Assassin's Nation, the book opens up with a page of the top 20 assassins ranked. And so from there, here it is. I have it open. So it gives you an idea of some of the people that you're going to see. Obviously, number one on the list is Fernando. So he must be somebody important. 1 through 5. And then I'm not sure if 19 and 20 are too important, but 20 has an interesting name, which you learn about during the issue. I can't say it on air because it's not a lot of cuss on air. And then the next page, it starts you off with, for the safety of yourself and others, please leave your guns here. And the ironic meaning of that, you'll see it throughout the issue. But the premise of the story, it follows a retired hired assassin. His name is Maxwell Bishop. This guy, to describe him, he is full of himself. He will take every opportunity to talk about himself and his glory days to anyone who is willing to listen. From the very beginning, you get that idea as he's trying to get information from someone, and he can't help but first tell him about things he used to do, what they used to call him. I mean, this guy has been beat up for information, and he is super annoyed to the point where he doesn't want to give him any information. He'd rather die because he's talking too much. And then, so next thing you know, we're transported into this, another room after somebody tries to kill Maxwell again and fail. And now we get to the premise of the book, where Maxwell has brought together the top 20 assassins to protect him from whoever's trying to kill him. Because in his mind, the best way to smoke out an assassin is to hire the best assassins who should be able to figure out whoever's trying to kill him's next move. And so throughout the issue, we get to see a lot of these assassins' personalities and kind of some of their quirks and how they got their names or just their just who they are in general. And so it's a really entertaining book. It's kind of weird, but kind of makes me wonder how many people are going to be standing by the end of this, by the end of this book. And how long they could even work together, if they're going to work together. It's a really good book. I'm not that biggest fan of Erica Henderson's artwork. She did the artwork for Unbeatable Schoolgirl and Jughead. I think her artwork fits Schoolgirl and Jughead a little bit better than this book, but, it was so entertaining that I didn't really mind it too bad. But because it deals with so many assassins and things like that, I'm just not sure if it completely fits, but I don't mind it. I'm not saying it's bad. It's just a little bit more cartoony, I guess I would call it, than what I would expect from a book like this. I'm trying to think of who I thought maybe would be better suited, but no, I'm not trying to talk bad about the artwork. I just, for the storyline, I think maybe it could use a different direction. Maybe even, Whoever's doing Crowded, I don't remember right now. I think maybe that maybe would have been a better choice. Rothstein and Ted Brandt, maybe that direction would have been a little bit better for the book. But no complaints here. Still a good book. Definitely going to pick up the second one. I suggest everybody else do the same.
Yeah, the only thing, Maxwell Bishop is the black guy that shows up who's been retired. The white guy who's being targeted is named Rankin. I don't know if we ever get his first name. But yeah, it's easy to get it confused because they don't really ever say the white guy's name except like in one spot. You have to really be paying attention. So yeah, I think Maxwell Bishop, actually the black guy who used to be number one and then retired, I think that he'll end up being a really important character. I would
say. Seems like they're setting it up, yeah.
But we don't know for sure yet. But yeah, it's pretty surprising when, you know, like you said, you get that top 20 list and you think they're all going to be important. And then the climax, it's like, wait, what just happened? And that's the only complaint I have. It's kind of confusing because you have a room full of people, some you know, supposedly, some you don't, some are important, some maybe aren't, but you know them for such a short period of time, it's hard to keep them straight. And it's hard, there's no way to even really know, like, okay, wait, who's on whose side here? Like, what's going on? That was the only part that I felt like I needed, like, a scorecard so I could keep track of, like, what exactly is going on. So, you know, it must not really be that important as a story because it does get really kind of confusing there. But yeah, it was intriguing enough and humorous enough that I will, I'll definitely pick up issue two. I also agree with you about the art. Erica Henderson's art, you know, like you said, I most closely associate her with Squirrel Girl also, Unbeatable Squirrel Girl, and that's kind of the way her art, that's where it works best. Here, with blood and guts and brains flying around, I think her style's just a little too cartoony for it. So, but again, it's not terrible art by any means. She's super talented.
No, not at all.
She's got a good sense of storytelling and panel layout and design and all that. Just I don't know that her style is best suited for this, but yeah, it was interesting. It had a lot of funny moments too. Like there's the one assassin, Dave, who's like asking, he's like a Star Trek
little. He's just starstruck by everyone.
And he's like asking for everybody's autograph. And like, especially when he gets Fernando's autograph, that was so funny.
My favorite assassin was the one who would commit mercy killings.
Oh yeah. And
people he's like, yeah, that's why I'm ranked, because I do a bunch of those jobs.
Yeah. Like, does that pay very much? No, not very much, but it's easy. Yeah. So yeah, there's a lot of humor in it for sure. So definitely recommend picking it up. All right. Let me see. Next book I'm going to talk about is Catwoman. I think it's issue 9, and we have a break from the normal creative team, probably for them to get caught up. So, it's interesting. So they used to be that back in the day, if the creative team got behind and you had to do a fill-in issue, they literally would have these fill-in issues in a filing cabinet somewhere, and they'd pull it out and they would tell this story without it really tying into the issue that came before, the issue that came after. And it would just be like totally out of the blue. And this is sort of like that, but yet it ties in enough because it's still set in the same like city, and it has the same, it sort of has the same kind of feel in terms of, you know, it's got a lot of the same supporting characters, but it's much more lighthearted in a way. And it ends up being a whole lot of fun. So it's written by Ram 5. The art is by John Timms, and the letters are by Josh Reed. And it's basically just Catwoman pulling off a heist. You know, some of her friends, some of her neighbors get in a little bit of trouble. And she, you know, if you know anything about Selina, she always has the back of those that she cares about. And so she's not about to let that stand. But of course, it's not that easy. What does every real good heist story need in order to make it a little more fun? Well, it needs a cop who's, you know, dedicated and tenacious and smart and is an actual threat to catch the perpetrators. And so we have that added in as well. And then the art by John Timms. For those of you not familiar with John Timms' work, he used to fill in a lot on Harley Quinn when Chad Harden needed a break. And so he kind of, his art has a similar style to Chad's. And he also handles the color work, which is done extremely well. Obviously, the heist takes place at night, so it's a lot of blues and greens, and it works really well. And then when Selina's in the safe, or the vault, I should say, it's, you know, a lot of reds and yellows. So a diverse color palette, but it works really, really well. His art is, it just suits her so perfectly. It's a little stylized, a little maybe cartoon or manga influence, and it's just a beautiful book to look at. And like I said, this was just really, really fun. Manny and I were talking before about how serious a book Catwoman has been, and that's totally fine. It suits what's going on in Selina's life after the, you know, the wedding that didn't happen. It needs to be a serious book because it's dealing with the fallout of that. But this was a nice break from that because, again, it was just a whole lot of fun and Selina doing what she does best. So it was great to take a break for a month from sort of the angst of the story that Joelle Jones has been telling that's really been tying in well with what's going on over in the Batman book. But it's nice to get a break from that every once in a while and get a story like this that's just a whole lot of fun. As opposed to, you look at the Batman book. So Tom King has been over there telling, you know, serious story after serious story. And Bruce, after being left at the altar, is all messed up and emotional. And it's psychological and full of, like, angst. And it's just a heavy, heavy book. And then when Tom finally takes a couple issues off, because of his TV stuff that he was working on, and Joshua Williamson comes in and does a crossover called The Price, it was not at all like this villain, right? The Price was just as, like, heavy and emotional and filled with, like, those negative emotions and, and Batman versus
Batman. You thought if it had the Flash in it, it would get a little lighter, but...
Yeah, but it didn't at all, you know? So, no. You would think, okay, at least we're getting a break from Tom King. Maybe it's going to have a chance to, like, catch our breath and before, you know, get a little lighter, have a little fun with Batman before we dive back into the, you know, psychological stuff that King is so good at. But no, man, Josh was right there with him. So it's just another reason that this issue was really, really great, and I enjoyed it so much because it was just a break from that. Like, I just got to read it. There wasn't a whole lot to think about. It was just a great heist story, beautiful art, beautiful color work. So definitely, if you haven't been reading Catwoman because you think that it's been too dark or too heavy, I would suggest picking up this issue. First of all, it has an amazing art germ variant cover, and second of all, if you just love Catwoman and watching her steal stuff, yeah, I pick this up for sure. That's totally what this issue is. All right, Manny, what do you have up next?
Next, I have Aftershocks Animosity 19, The Master's House, written by Marguerite Bennett, with artwork by not Rafael de la Torre, but Elton Tomasi, with colors by Rob Schwager. And so this one, issue 19, this is probably a good jumping on point if you don't want to go back and read the other 18 issues, but you're crazy if you think you shouldn't go back and read the other 18 issues, because this is a really good book from the issue one all the way through. So far in the story, right now, they have just taken down the Walled City, which was controlled by the headmistress, had brainwashed quite a bit of people. I mean, she was forcefully making women breed, and that was really, really creepy. And we saw last issue how she was doing it, what she was doing with the family members, because for a while you only saw women in the encampment, and some of the men were soldiers and things like that. But when you found out that she was really keeping a lot of these women underground, that was crazy. And then came the battle with the animals and with the security force and what they were going to do, only to find out that a lot of these families had been broken apart by the headmistress, and that's kind of how she was keeping everybody at bay. So this one kicks off with a camp with all the animals back together, the group from Animosity, and also the all the people from the Walled City. And they're really trying to figure out what happens next, because they pretty much destroyed the Wall City, and now they're all thinking about what's next. Some of the animals that have been there for a while have also started to think about, well, when does this end? Because they've had to fight through so many battles to survive. From encampment to encampment to encampment. And so where does it end? When is it that they're going to be able to find a place that they can call home? Well, when are they going to be able to just kind of settle down and live a quote unquote normal life, which if you think about it, is not, there's nothing normal about the entire situation of the book. And so a lot of animals are asking themselves this question. A lot of the people are just talking about what happened to them and how they got involved with the headmistress, and where they were when everything took place. And I mean, everyone's pretty lost at the moment, trying to figure out what's next. A couple of people who aren't really worried about it is Jesse, as well as Sandor. Who are still wanting to go to California. They said, well, you guys do what you must, but we're going to California. And it's at that point that Mittens lets them know that they're looking for the leader. And Jesse thinks she's talking about Sandor, and she's like, no, they want you. So that's when they go out and they start talking about what's next and things like that. So it's really interesting because it kind of takes it to a deeper level now. I mean, after all this fighting, it makes sense that as any character, you would think that they just want to settle down. They just want to live somewhere and not have to worry about death and fighting and whether it's animals or humans. They talk a lot about domestication too and how they're going to be able to work with each other. So it's a really, really, really wordy issue, but a very, very interesting issue. The one thing I noticed right off the bat is that Rafael de la Torre is not doing the artwork on this issue. He did do the cover with Marcelo Maiolo, but not the interiors. So the artwork obviously is different, and it's a little, maybe it's the coloring, but it's a little less refined, I would say. Maybe that's not the word I'm looking for. It's a little grainier, there's a word I'm looking for, and I can't come up with it right now. So it definitely loses a step in artwork compared to Rafael de la Torre, especially in facial features is where I notice it the most. And it did take me out of the story a little bit, but not too much. I'm going to be interested to see if he just took a break, or if he's coming back, or if finally Jimmy and Amanda convinced him to do more Super Zero from Animosity, which would be amazing. Every time I see them, I bug them that I want that book back. So Raphael's freed, and maybe we can get a second arc of Super Zero. But yeah, Animosity 19, it's a really, really interesting issue. Just, you know, grab a cup of coffee and just really get into it, because there's a lot to digest in this issue. It's not a quick read at all.
Yeah, he might just be taking a single issue off, though, right? I mean, yeah.
I know, I think so.
Yeah, maybe he just needed a break. I mean, I'd be all for a return of Super Zero also, but I don't know. One issue is too soon to say. All right, up next I have a title that a lot of people have been talking about, so it's the reason I picked it up. These aren't creators that I'm really that familiar with, but they really promoted the heck out of it. People were talking about it like, oh, this is the next Saga, which I don't even read Saga, which I know a lot of people are probably screaming at their podcast device right now. But honestly, I've never read Saga, so I can't say whether it's good or not. But the thing about, I get so tired of hearing Saga that it turned me off to it, and I don't want to read it for that reason. Maybe I'll get around to it someday. I don't know. But I feel like so many people have built it up. If I ever did get around to reading it, it can only disappoint me, you know, because my expectations are so high. But anyway, the book that I'm talking about here is called Little Bird. It's created by Ian Bertram and Darcy Van Poelgeest. I think that's how you say it, Poegeest. So Darcy writes it. Ian is the artist. We have colors by Matt Hollinsworth and letters by Aditya Bidikar. And we have design by Ben Didier. It says, Little Bird was written on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam people, Musqueam, and it's set in Canada, and in the Rocky Mountains of Canada, with these native people who are basically fighting against religious oppressors. It seems like it's the kind of the Catholic Church gone crazy, gone overboard with power. There's no longer the United Nations. Instead, it's like the United Church, and it seems like they're the ones that kind of are in charge of the earth. Like they have managed to take over. And so it seems like a lot of these natives who maybe have their own belief systems are being persecuted by the church. And because of that, they see these other native peoples who may have their own beliefs as heretics. And they feel like that gives them the right to persecute them. So it's an interesting concept, and it gets really complicated really fast. But the thing that really stands out more than anything about this is the art. It's this really kind of strange sort of art style. I can't even necessarily describe it. I've seen this sort of art style before, and I can't remember where. But it's, yeah, like I said, I can't really describe it. It's a little cartoonish in a way, but also very stylized, almost like comic strip. Like maybe Doonesbury would be sort of an influence on it. But it also has a lot of detail. And it's certainly, you know, he doesn't pay a lot of attention to anatomy, especially when it comes to animals and things like that. He just kind of does what he wants, and it works for the story, but I just don't know that I'm a fan of it. You know, maybe a little Jeff Darrow when you want to talk about how much detail is in the art. So for me, the story is interesting enough, and I'm curious to see where it goes, but the art just, I don't know. I don't care for it, and it may be a deal breaker for me. I may not hang around. I think I'm going to read one more issue just to kind of see, because it is an interesting story, and it's kind of hard to tell exactly where it's going to go just based on the first issue, because we do meet Little Bird, and she's sort of the main character, and then she sort of stages a prison break to rescue this hero of the rebellion, and it doesn't necessarily seem like he wants to be rescued, or he wants to be involved. And so where the second issue goes, it's going to probably dictate whether or not I keep reading it. But again, I just feel like if it was a different artist on the book, I would be in for sure. And I'm not even sure who, I mean, I haven't thought about it. I'm not even sure what artist I would want on here, but, it's an interesting enough story. I probably would say, yeah, pick it up, because I'm sure there's a lot of people that are really going to love it. Because again, that art style, I feel like it's going to be really polarizing. Like, you either are really going to love it and get a lot out of it, or you're going to be turned off by it. I will say also the use of color, it's done very, very well to help set tone and mood. And it's also an extremely varied color palette, which I find interesting. And it goes to show just how much ground is covered in this issue. A lot happens in this first issue. So, you know, it's Matt Hollinsworth, who's a colorist whose work that I'm familiar with, and that I notice. Like, there's been plenty of times where I've read books where I say, wow, the color's really good. And I look at it, and yep, sure enough, it's Matt Hollinsworth. I've never seen him color a bad issue. I've never seen his work look poor. It's always well above average. So no surprise here that he's maintaining those standards. So I know a lot of people were probably curious about this book, heard a lot about it, as I did. So yeah, I think it's worth, at the very, very least, it's worth picking up off the rack and flipping through it. And again, if you can, if you like that style of art, then I think you're really going to dig it, because the story is pretty intriguing. All right, what do you have up next, Manny?
Next, I have Red Hood Outlaw number 32. This is part one of Prince of Gotham, written by Scott Bell, with, as written here, pictures by Steven Segovia, artwork by Steven Segovia, and colors by Rex Locus. Man, Scott Bell has kept his book consistently good. Nothing too over the top, nothing completely bland. And I mean, just when I wonder what they're going to do next, you know, he comes in surprising me with something good. The last few issues, he had been trying to take down Serenity. No, that's not what it was. Shoot. Solarity. Sorry, there you go, Solarity. And we also had the reintroduction of Bunker, which was great. And because that's one of the, when the new Teen Titans came out, that's one of the characters I really liked, Miguel, who can kind of construct bricks. It was a cool character. So at the last bit of the issue, we saw Red Hood comes back to Gotham, and before that, he pays tribute to his fallen friend, Arsenal, who we know through Heroes in Crisis had died. And so now we find him in the first pages of this book. He is now the owner of the Iceberg Lounge, which to me was eyebrow raising. And apparently also to Alfred, who finds out on TV that he is the new owner of Iceberg Lounge, to the point that he drops a knife. And so, you know, it's kind of surprising. He's teamed up with some people that he's fought before to take care of any problems and to run the club, which I also find interesting. I actually find him very, very appealing as the head of the Iceberg Lounge. And he's teamed up still with Miguel. And then also with, Wingman, who is his wingman as well. And so pretty much the issue goes on talking about really the, just, you know, how he's running the day to day, how he's also working to take down certain bad guys in the city. And it's funny because all this happens and Bruce Wayne, Batman have no idea until he finds out, and then he comes looking for him pretty quick. And kind of like, you know, I get the sense that, and this is pretty obvious, that Batman hates the fact that he can't control Jason Todd the same way he can control some of the other members of the Bat family. He's not the one that falls in line. I mean, even Nightwing does, but not Jason Todd. He does his own thing. He has his own way of doing things, and he's going to do it. It's not his fault that the Penguin went missing. And so now he's going to do things his way in Gotham, and there's really nothing Batman can do about it. One interesting aspect of this issue is something I'm looking forward to is what's the deal with Bunker? What's going on in his head? What are his true powers that are kind of dangerous? Because when they go back to look at the prison, it's just a giant sinkhole. And Bunker is trying to, gauge how much, my bad, I think I got carried away. So, he kind of has, it's interesting because it seems like something's going to happen with him. We're going to find out a little bit more about his, what he's capable of. And, just a good setup issue, nice cliffhanger. Really cool moment. Really, really cool page of Batman diving off of a ledge. That I thought was done really, really, really well. Overall, I like the artwork in the book. And just consistently good. Red Hood Outlaw 32. I would call this one of my favorite books that's been consistently good. Along with the now canceled Green Arrow, that was consistently good as well. But I'm kind of surprised that Red Hood Outlaw has lasted this long. I never thought that it would outlast a Green Arrow book, or it would also outlast a Green Lantern book, because the Green Lantern is gone and now it's just Green Lantern. So, I mean, just, well done. And I look forward to the next issue.
So the Red Hood owns the Iceberg Lounge. Is that what you said?
Yes.
Okay. I'm not even going to, because I'm sure it would spoil, but wow, that is, yeah. Okay. Fair enough. All right. Let me go ahead and talk about my next book. It's Blackbird, speaking of penguins or birds or fowl. It's written by Sam Humphreys. The art is by Jen Bartel. Layout art by Paul Renwand. Colors are by Triona Farrell, and letters are by Jody Wynn. And I always have to call out the colors on this book. Triona Farrell. This along with Ayasola are the two best colored books on stands right now. I mean, the color work in here is just stunningly good. It's very primary. And it suits the story. It suits Jen Bartel's art perfectly. The other thing you notice about the artwork from Jen Bartel is how much fashion sense she has. Like, the way she dresses her characters is super interesting. And so you really, it becomes really obvious when you read this book, how much of a fan of fashion Jen must be. So in that way, it gives the book a really slick look. You know, it's the story of these paragons, as they're known, these magic wielders who sort of don't appear to have, like, they sort of live in secret, right? The story takes place in L.A., Southern California, and there's all these different territories. And when people look at these paragons, these magic wielders, they just see kind of these glamorous everyday people. They don't realize that they have this magic in them. But because of that setting, you know, when you think of LA, what you think of fashion, everybody's concerned with how they look and everything. And so, that's sort of, between the colors and the artwork, that sort of look is very unique to this book and very distinctive. And it serves the story so well, because that's part of the story. That's part of the sort of the conceit that these people have, the arrogance that these magic users have, that they feel they're above everybody, and they have wealth, and they look good, they're all thin, and it's that whole LA lifestyle. So it suits the book really well, and it inadvertently informs sort of the the attitudes of these people that you're reading about. And then, so that's kind of the backstory. And then the specific story talks about a Blackbird, which is one of these magic users who has sort of gone rogue and turned their back on the rest of the magic society. And they're called Blackbirds once they've kind of drifted away or run away or whatever it is, for whatever reason, they've left and turned their back on it. And so it's the story of a Blackbird who eventually gets sucked back in. And it's really a story about her daughter and the things that her daughter always suspected. But because she wasn't raised in that world, because her mother turned her back on it, she has a bit of a journey to discover her heritage and learn about magic and learn things about her mother that she didn't know. And so in that way, it's sort of a story of discovery. And then once that happens, it kind of shifts to really examining familial relationships and how things are never as easy as you want them to be or think they should be. It's always complicated, and people do things for their own reasons. And sometimes when you do something to try to protect someone you care about, it can completely backfire. And so there's a lot of relationship stuff in there to be explored as well. And I think Sam Humphries when it comes to writing stories about relationships and emotions and kind of the tough work sometimes that you have to put in order to repair relationships, Sam Humphries is a really good writer when it comes to writing those kind of stories, making it relatable, making it personal, and not ignoring sometimes the negative aspects of choices people make and emotion and anxiety and mental health and all those kind of issues. He doesn't shy away from that kind of thing at all. And it makes for really good storytelling and very relatable reads, because even if we ourselves as readers aren't dealing with those kind of things or have dealt with those kind of things, we certainly know somebody who has. And so when you take this, this gorgeous artwork, beautiful sense of fashion, a great from Jen Bartel, and great colors from Triona Farrell, and you add in this wonderful narrative and this rich magical world that Sam Humphries has created, it's a really, really good book. I heard a lot of buzz about it when the first issue came out. I haven't heard a lot about it recently, so I wanted to be sure to keep carrying the torch for it, because it's a really, really great book. And I think a lot of people can relate to some of the things that the characters in this book are going through, especially when it comes to relationships with your parents. The main character Nina, she's angry at her mom. She's not necessarily getting along with her mom because of the choices that her mother made. But at the same time, as you read the story and we see as readers the reasons that her mom made those choices, it makes total sense. And you could easily see yourself making that same choice in that situation. But for Nina, it's hard, it's hard to reconcile. She's kind of too close to it to understand and to see it. And again, I think that's relatable as well. So really, really great title. Really been enjoying Blackbird. So definitely check it out if you have not done so already. All right, Manny, you have one more book to mention?
See, I have one more book, and that's going to be The Batman Who Laughs, The Grim Knight, #1, written by Scott Snyder and James Tynion IV, with artwork by Eduardo Rizzo, colored by Dave Stewart, and Doc has the regular cover. But did you see that cover by Gabrielle Delato?
Oh yeah, I ordered that cover.
That cover is fantastic. I mean, just it's a Batman that we're not used to seeing, and just the blue hues, and the just done so well. I've stared at it for a while now. Anyway, back to the book. So you could almost guess the premise of the book is, so what would happen is that night in the alley when Bruce's parents died, what would happen if he shot back? What would happen if instead of him taking a stance against guns, this heightened his senses and in a way, in a manner of speaking, and decided to take that power into his own hands that Joe Chill used to kill his parents. And that's really what we have here. And so it's really interesting because it continues on with where we left off with the Grim Knight, with Jim Gordon. And you really find out about the reason why Jim Gordon is such an important character to him, or an important person, because if Batman decides to take justice into his own hands, and I put justice in commas, and actually execute criminals and villains and whatsoever, then who becomes his real enemy? And that's the law. And in Gotham, who's head of the law? That's going to be James Gordon. And so it's a really, really fascinating story about Jim Gordon just making sure that he's always going to do everything by the book, and he's going to bring him in. And it's a trait of Gordon that we see time and time again. We've seen it in classic stories like The Killing Joke. We've seen it on TV shows. We've seen it in film. Jim Gordon is always going to be a character who does everything by the book. He follows the law, and he full-heartedly believes it, that's the only way the system's going to work. Now, looking at the other side, through the book, we get to see the same images of Bruce training and the bat flying through the window, but things are a little differently, obviously, because now he has weapons. He uses weapons. He embraces them. And also, he doesn't take chances. He's pretty much, and I know it's been said before, by other people, but he pretty much becomes a Punisher. So, it's funny, one of my favorite boxes is, in his time, he's never faced the kind of colorful enemies the Batman of other worlds did. There was never a murderous clown, though he remembered killing a man in a red hood at Ace Chemical. Which really had me thinking, if he just got rid of some of these people, he wouldn't necessarily have that many villains to cause problems in the future. Because obviously the psychology of Batman has always been questioned, that he actually needs these villains in order to fill his weird need of to fight someone. But that's a whole other topic. It's really interesting to read and see this version of Batman and what he does to make the city quote unquote safe. And then his fights with Jim Gordon, and then just to see the reaction of some of the people also that he saves, because there's a couple that is going through a similar situation that he did, that Bruce had when he was young. But this time there was somebody there to save them. And he saves them by killing them. So, I guess you can take it as, you can see it depending on your perspective. This family didn't lose their lives because this Batman killed a criminal. And meanwhile, Jim Gordon believes that he's breaking the law. There's no due process, sorry. And so, I mean, just it's a solid issue. I like the watercolors that are used. and it's I think it's done really, really well. Really good storytelling, and then it ties it up nice in a bow to bring you back to the Batman Who Laughs. So just a solid one shot issue, I think. And I look forward to seeing more of this character. It would be interesting to get more of him to dig deeper into, you know, how this Batman operates. Where is his sense of morality? Because you can tell that there's some there, but in the end, he's still going to kill you if you're the bad guy. So, go and get this. Even if you necessarily haven't been reading some of the other things, like The Batman Who Laughs, or it's just a really good opposite view of what Batman could have been if he became someone quite like the Punisher, actually.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, obviously that Punisher comparison is an obvious one. I don't know. To me, he's wildly different than that. I mean, the guns, obviously, and then he kills people. He kills bad people who he thinks are bad people. I get that comparison, but I don't know. He feels different than the Punisher to me in a way.
No, definitely different than the Punisher, but the obvious comparison is that he handles the bad guy. He doesn't just let him back out on the street.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. But I don't know. I feel like he's more ruthless than the Punisher because he also has no problem killing cops. Like, if you get in my way, then you're just as bad as the bad guys, and I'm going to kill you too. I think Punisher tries to be a little more diplomatic about it, but
I mean, I don't want to give too much away, but maybe I'll talk to you about it off air. But just that family twist also, in the Batcave, I was like, wow,
yeah,
that was kind of upsetting to say the least.
Yeah, I agree. All right, my last book I'm going to talk about is Hawkman number 10, written by Robert Venditti. We have pencils by Brian Hitch, inks are by Andrew Curry and Hitch, colors by Jeremiah Skipper, letters by Starkings and Comicraft. This is part three of the final story arc that's going to resolve resolve as best as Robert Venditti can the sort of idea that Hawkman has all these different versions and all this different history and weird continuity or whatever. Venditti's done an incredible job of explaining that away and making it make sense. This whole idea that Hawkman has been reincarnating over time and space, so every time he dies, comes back as somebody new and different. So that's why we have Carter Hall and Qatar Hall, Hole from Thanagar, and it makes sense. It explains how he could be an archaeologist in ancient Egypt, but he also could be a Thanagarian policeman. And so I think it was really brilliant and inspired, even if, as Venditti himself said, he kind of came up with the idea because he was stupid. He basically didn't know the history of Hawkman at all, and when the little he did know, he just made that assumption. And then when he read it and found out it wasn't, he's like, wait, what? And so then when it came time to fix it, he's like, why not this idea that I, you know, inadvertently, this assumption that I accidentally made. So that idea of him reincarnating across time and space plays a central role in this issue. And it means that the part four of this cataclysm, where I imagine we're going to have the resolution of Hawkman's sort of origin and put to rest the sort of part of his past that he's ashamed of and he's been trying to atone for his entire life, his role with the Deathbringers. It seems like in the next issue that's going to be resolved. And the way it's going to be resolved looks to be really, really interesting. So when you couple this incredible scene, I don't want to give it away, obviously, because I don't want to spoil, but it's the scene in the book where Hawkman comes to the realization that everything he's been doing and all these reincarnations throughout his history have been leading to this. And the scene is so awesome and so amazing, and it's rendered so expertly by Brian Hitch that on the strength of that, I have to give this my book of the week. I almost went with Justice League Dark because it was so amazing, but this is so important because Hawkman is a character that's been around for so long, and seeing the stakes that he's facing here that are, you know, he's one of the oldest characters in the DC universe, and the cataclysm that's happening has everything to do with the life, his first life, the first life he led as the leader and the general of the Deathbringers. And so you could kind of in a way say that this story has been in the making since the very beginning of the DC universe. So it's so important. It's so central to who Hawkman is. And I was reading this issue, and the first thing I thought when I was done reading this issue is I want Robert Venditti to write Hawkman for like 100+ issues. Like, I want Robert Venditti Hawkman for like 10 years. I want him writing this book. I want it to be a really long run. I know that those like long runs like that, I mean, who knows if we'll ever see, you know, like another Peter David run on the Hulk. I mean, what did he write the Hulk for, like almost 20 years or something? Just like a really, really long time, right? I want that for Venditti because I think this is the character he was born to write. Like, as much as I love his work over at Valiant on Exo Manowar, and then what he did with Green Lantern, love that as well. His work on Flash, like I'm a fan of the guy. I like the ideas he comes up with. I like the fact that he takes these characters that have been around for decades and comes up with new and fresh ideas. And so I want to see what he can do if he stays on a character like Hawkman, because as much as I loved all his previous work, this is the best thing he's ever done. The ideas he's come up with, the way it incorporates with the history of the DCU, I want him on Hawkman for a really, really long time, so that any writer who touches Hawkman after this is going to be borrowing from the ideas that Venditti uses, right? And I don't mean they're going to be retelling stories or whatever, but I just think that Venditti's laying such important groundwork here. And Hawkman has been such a mess for so long that any writer who writes Hawkman from here forward needs to be sure that whatever they do fits in with the ideas of the origin that Venditti has established, and sort of the special continuity and the explanations and the reasoning for why Hawkman's continuity has been what it has been. They need to make sure that whatever story they tell fits in with that. So borrow from the ideas and the groundwork and the foundation that Venditti has laid. And if you want to build on that, you know, tell your own stories, by all means. But again, I hope that doesn't happen for a long time, because I really want to see Venditti just like keep creating these awesome ideas for Hawkman and just have a really, really long run. So when people look back on Hawkman as a character and they say, you know, who's the greatest Hawkman writer of all time? Who's the one that really put the stamp on the character? And say, oh, people say, oh, Robert Venditti. The way people talk about, you know, Frank Miller Batman Year One, or the Geoff Johns run on Flash, Dan Slott on Spider-Man, these quintessential runs where people say, or Peter David on Hulk, like I mentioned a little while ago, when people look at these characters and say, wow, this character almost becomes synonymous with this writer because it's the best run on that character that's ever been done. So, and I know Rob is, if he listens to this, probably going to be shaking his head saying, you can't put me in the company with those other kind of writers because, you know, Frank Miller Daredevil or whatever is not, he just doesn't see himself that way. He's far too humble. But I have to give him credit. I really think that's how incredible and how seminal and how perfect his run on Hawkman has been. So it definitely gets my book of the week this week. And incredible art too by Brian Hitch. Also the best work of his career. I think I've seen him say it. Venditti's been saying it. You know, Hitch's artwork is always very cinematic, and there's no difference here when it's this big, huge battle over London. The city size, the cityscapes, the views from the sky, whether it's the winged antagonists flying through the air, or the people that they're attacking being dropped from a great height, and Hawkman rescuing them. Just incredible work. You get a really cool sense of movement, and I don't think it's easy to put as much detail and draw as many figures flying through the air. By no means is it easy, and Hitch handles it expertly well, so I have to give him props. Really, really great issue. Definitely my book of the week. I have a feeling I know the answer, Manny, but what's your book of the week?
The Batman Who Laughs, Green Knight, number one.
Yeah, I figured that's what it was going to be. All right, well, let me give a rundown really quickly on some of the other titles you should be looking out for today. We mentioned Animosity from Aftershock. Also, Dark Arc number 15 is in stores today. Over at Boom, we have the third issue of the new Buffy the Vampire Slayer series. Meanwhile, at DC, in addition to the books we mentioned, we have cover number 6 from David Mack and Brian Michael Bendis. That's the final issue of that series. And there's a Jim Lee variant. It's basically Jim Lee's face, Jim Lee's giant face on the cover. We also have Flash number 66, which is sort of a recap of the history of the Trickster. We also have Supergirl number 28. We'll be covering that on an upcoming Superman Sunday, as well as Superman number 9 from Brian Michael Bendis that has an appearance by the Crime Syndicate. So can't wait to talk about that on Superman Sunday. Over at Image, in addition to the books that we were talking about, we have Cyberforce number 9 and Freeze number 4 from Top Cow. We also have the latest issue of Oblivion Song, issue number 13 by Robert Kirkman. At Marvel, another new number 1 for Conan with Age of Conan. I think it's Belit. It's B-E-L-I-T. And we also have another new Age of X-Men number 1 with Apocalypse and the X-Tracks number 1. Amazing Spider-Man from Nick Spencer and Ryan Otley is up to number 17. We have a Magnificent Miss Marvel number 1. For the first time, we're going to have somebody besides G. Willow Wilson writing Miss Marvel as Saladin Ahmed takes over that character. And also the latest issue of X-23 with number 10 and X-Force with number 4 from Ed Brisson. Finally, from Valiant, we have Livewire number 4. That's been a really incredible title, so I'm really looking forward to talking about Livewire on an upcoming episode of the Valiant Sunday. So, anything else you want to mention, Manny?
Nope, you covered it.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening. Hope you get out there to your comic book shop today and pick up some really cool books. Just a reminder that this episode has been brought to you by Aftershock Comics. Do yourself a favor and head over to aftershockcomics.com. As I mentioned earlier, they have series synopses, creator rundowns, diamond codes to pre-order the books, also links to Comixology where you can get them digitally. Also, be sure to sign up for their newsletter. They just put out the kind of their new format of newsletter today, which has some really great information about upcoming releases, upcoming conventions they're going to be at. They have the Aftershock Army. that's starting to form now. I'm sure there'll be information about that coming up soon as well. You'll get the chance to show your love for Aftershock and maybe even become more involved and get special swag and all that kind of great stuff. So again, they're a really great publisher. Really believe in a lot of what they're doing. Everybody that works over there is really passionate about comics and the sequential art storytelling medium, and it really shows in the quality of their titles, whether it's really great creators telling edgy stories, or the quality of their product itself. The hardbacks they do, the anthologies they do, it's always top quality. You get a really good product. And again, they are over at aftershockcomics.com. Really encourage you to go over and check them out. Thanks for joining us, everybody. Please tell your friends about us. Subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. The Comic Source is a member of the LRM Podcast Network, so when you visit the site, be sure to check out some of our other podcasts like Los Fanboys, our official movie and TV podcast hosted by Joseph Jammer Medina, Netflix and Chill, hosted by Nick and Carrie, covering a wide variety of film and television topics with Game of Thrones and Star Wars as particular favorites, and finally, Mike and Mark's Marvelous Adventures, as these two former athletes share their love of sports and geek culture by chatting about anything and everything sports and geek related. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.